you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, Expanse fans, and welcome to The Churn, a podcast about The Expanse. This is episode 6 of season 3, Immolation, and I am Adam Swiderski, the editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi Wire, and one of your hosts for the show. Unfortunately, my co-host, Cher, could not be with us this week. She had the loss of a beloved pet this past weekend, one of her dogs, and our hearts and thoughts go out to her on that. Anyone who is been an animal parent knows how devastating that kind of thing can be. So, but she'll be back. In the meantime, you're stuck with me and my guests, as always, this week, Ty and Daniel, James S.A. Corey. Say hello, fellas.
Hello, fellas. That was
there. You go.
Yeah, that's the way it works every time. That joke never gets old. Never.
It's not.
No,
it's not. It's immortal.
Evergreen.
But. So, a lot to talk about in the episode this week. This was a very eventful episode, one of the more satisfying episodes for me as an Expanse fan, full of great moments. But before we get to that, obviously, I think we'd be remiss not to address the elephant in the room a little bit. And it's a little weird for me personally, because I obviously Sci-Fi Wire is owned by Sci-Fi, but I... And Sci-Fi Wire and I individually have zero input on the programming side of things. So the fact that Sci-Fi is not picking up The Expanse again after season 4 was revealed this past week, obviously.
After season three. People are going to freak out if you say that.
I really, there you go. That's the official tweets going out now. Sci-Fi says it's picking up season 4. No. I'm sorry. That's my error. But it's not picking it up for season 4. Went out this week. Not the end of things, hopefully. And, you know, hopefully there might be still a chance for Alcon, the production company, to find another home for it. As a fan, obviously really rough news for me. You know, even though I am technically employed by the network again, something that I would not have chosen were it up to me, and would love. There's so much, especially as someone who's read the books, you know, knowing what's to come, really... A bummer on that, but just Ty and Daniel, I just wanted to get, I mean, obviously I know it's not great news for you guys, but I wanted to get your take on things and on the run and kind of where things are now.
Well, you know, as you said, we're kind of in a weird limbo at this point. Sci-Fi has bailed and Alcon is trying to find a new home for it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. It's kind of odd. The thing that I keep coming back to, though, is that, you know, I feel like I can't feel bad about the show that we've done. The stuff that we have is it's good stuff. And I was thinking about something our showrunner Narain Shankar always says, which is, you know, for a show to succeed, 1,000 things have to go right, and for a show to fail, 3 things have to go wrong. I feel like we're at like 2.5 things going wrong right now. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out.
But there's still a half thing left. So, you know, hopefully it can get turned around.
You know, if it does, that will be awesome.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, we will have done 36 episodes of work that I'm really proud of. That's as a fail position, as everything has finally fallen apart, and all I have is 36 hours of really first quality television of a science fiction property that will be part of the conversation for the rest of my life, that's an okay fail position. I can live with that.
Yeah, it's not a bad legacy.
I'm saying.
Ty, do you have any thoughts you wish to share at this point?
But not really. I mean,
all right.
Yeah, Daniel said. we still have anybody who doesn't know where it's all going to end up and wants to know. We still have all these books.
Yep.
Yes.
Always a plus.
So
I've heard of these books.
Yeah. So it gives us an alternative.
The other thing that's been really amazing to me in the wake of all this is the outpouring of fan support. I read today they're actually renting a plane to do a banner flyby of Amazon headquarters. Is that correct?
That is what I have heard. We had nothing to do with that.
No, of course not.
It wasn't Alcon doing that. That's folks. And it's kind of amazing.
Very amazing. I mean, that's, you know, there's all kinds of, this happens a lot now when fans latch onto a show and then unfortunately it doesn't get to continue. And you'll see a lot of Save Our Show movements. But man, the one around the Expanse has been particularly passionate, really impressive. As someone who's been in this field for a long time, that level of we're going to actually do a flyby of the Amazon headquarters with a banner asking to save the show. I mean, that's amazing. So shout outs to, you know, everyone out there listening, all the Expanse fans out in the world. You guys are awesome. And we thank you. And obviously, we're going to, I think, having spoken to Ty and Daniel, we're going to continue out the string for season 3 on the churn. And, you know, who knows if the show sticks around, gets cat on somewhere, maybe we'll keep going. We'll see how it goes. But again, you guys, the Expanse fans out there, can't pay enough tribute to you guys. And thanks for listening. And we're going to keep talking.
We're gonna be here till the bitter end. Whatever that looks like.
That's
right. We're in.
That's right. That's right. We're riding this one straight into the suns. No, but great. So season 3 continues this week with episode 6, Immolation. Wow, was there a lot going on? It's funny because I think I've said that in about every episode this season. There's a lot going on this episode, but this one in particular felt so full of incident. I think I looked down at about 25 minutes in and couldn't believe that there were still 25 minutes left to go because we already so much had happened. And so, like on a micro level, it's not even like the pieces moving around. So much action, several loose ends kind of got tied up. And we said goodbye to some people that have been with us for a while in the storyline, some of them for the better and some of them for the worse. And then of course the end is, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you think everything's okay. Well, surprise. Here's this other thing.
There was that other thing in the background all this time. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So man, what an episode. I guess, I mean, obviously most of this episode kind of centered around the action, on Io. And, you know, with a couple of different theaters going on there, we had the ground assault by Bobby and the rest of the Rossi away team. And we had what was going on out in orbit with the Agatha King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then some stuff on the Rossi as well. So just a lot of action.
Yeah, but we also had the stuff back on Earth that had some of my favorite moments in the series.
So was this the Sean Doyle episode you were talking
this
about?
This is the Sean Doyle episode I was talking about. This was the reveal at the end, that scene with where he's being confronted with the evidence of his treason, and his response is not even to talk to Sorrento Gillis. He doesn't even talk to the attorney, the Secretary General. He just turns to Anna and lays it out. That was a tremendously hard scene for us to find in the writing room, and it took a lot of different versions and a lot of different iterations before we landed there. And I just thought Sean killed it. I just thought that was beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for anybody catching up, Anna plays the smoking gun video message for Sorrento Gillis and lays Aaron Wright's plans out for everyone to see, or not for everyone to see, but obviously for the Secretary General to see. And yeah, man, when he's confronted with it and just The contempt
that just radiates off of him. And that last moment when he's before they lead him away, when he's says, I fought for the Earth, you fought for yourself. The planet deserved better than you. It's like in that moment you're like, yeah, no, that's true. All of those things, all of the things he said are true.
It's Sorrento Gillis then just immediately reconfirms with what he says to Anna afterwards.
Yeah, no, he was an empty suit from start to finish. And, you know, it's interesting the way that you can set up a character to be a thing and have this whole story arc around them that confirms they are absolutely that thing that you said right at the first and still have it be kind of satisfying. You know, we talk about character growth and character arcs, and there's also a beauty in, yeah, no, the snake is a snake. That's that's the way it is.
Honestly, even as they were leading him out of the room in cuffs, I was ready for some kind of twist right there. I was like, he's going to figure something out and just turn the screws somehow, which I think is a testament to how that character of Aaron Wright has been developed over the seasons on this show, because I couldn't even believe, I was like, he's going to get out of it somehow.
Well, and he didn't get shot.
That's true.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So who knows if we'll hear from Aaron Wright again.
I do. I totally know that, but yeah.
And you can neither confirm nor deny.
I will neither confirm nor deny.
Excellent. But yeah, and it's just a really, I mean, it's one of those moments with Sorrento Gillis where you think, okay, this guy finally is going to find his spine, and then for him to immediately turn to Anna and say, you know, make it all about his legacy, and to see the look on her face as she realizes that the person who she thought he was is gone, just really, it made Aaron Wright's arrest, even as satisfying as it was on a certain level, kind of a bitter pill, because you're like, okay, now it wasn't the great triumph necessarily that we hoped it would be.
Yeah, no, it's the world has not changed. That player is just off the board.
Yeah, but and I mean, obviously, I think the revelation of all this will have some. You know, we didn't see the declaration of peace and the truce with Mars or anything like that on screen, but it's going to have huge repercussions for the geopolitical, I don't know if you would say geopolitical.
I know, right? Solar political? I don't know.
Solar political, whatever. Situation going on. Yeah. Anyway, so that was kind of the UN of it all. Really, that was like one of several just great peak satisfying moments in this episode. I mean, let's see what else. Just to touch on the briefer side of things, the Agatha King section was really just, I mean,
that was gut wrenching, wasn't it? That was
absolutely terrible. Absolutely, and wrapped that up in a way that I certainly was not expecting. That, you know, seeing the way the protomolecule spreads now, and the most devastating moment for me, honestly, was the first shot of Cotillard in the reactor chamber when you see when you get the first hint of blue in his face, and it's really subtly shot, which I thought was cool. It's not like there's not a music sting where you realize he's infected. It's just like, oh yeah, he's infected by the protomolecule, and that was just such a sad moment. I was like, no, because that character has just been so steady, you know, throughout his entire run on the show.
And it was a tiny little part in the book. I mean, Cotillard does appear in the book. He's a character in Caliban's War, and he's tiny. I mean, he's mentioned like five times, and then we got Nick in there, and it's another one of the situations you think, well, it's a bigger part now. now that's going to be a bigger part. How's that going to work?
So that was another situation where the part came from the performance, or the expansion of the part.
Partly.
Yeah, I mean, it came from It came from some of the changes, structural changes we made from the book, and it came from having a performer come in who you don't want to waste. You know, you want to use as much of as they can give you, and he can give you a lot. He did a really wonderful job of making this character a foil for Avasarala and a character in his own right and a third kind of axis with Bobby and Avasarala, and you know, it popped, and that's wonderful. It's wonderful when that happens.
And he goes out like a boss. He takes a whole battleship with him.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That was, I mean, as sad as I was to see him go, what a way to go.
And the scene where he's freed, where the Larson comes in and it's like, you know, all right, I don't even know what we're fighting for. And it's like, yeah, that's a tragic little moment too.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole, I mean, first of all, like even the opening shot of it where you see Kotiar basically just floating out of his chair. It's funny. I made that little gag about, you know, has he been stuck in that chair the whole time? But then the first shot we see of him is him floating in zero G.
Yeah.
That was a really beautiful moment too. And it's just funny because you forget almost the whole magnetic boots of it all a lot of the time, or I did anyway. Mm-hmm. So you see him floating, then you see someone walk in, and there's that brief moment of like, wait a minute, and then you realize what's going on. But
well, and then you shoot the guy, and he doesn't fall. I love that.
That was awesome too.
Was that? Yeah. I mean, that was. Oh yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was. I was like, wait, is he still up because of his infection with the proto molecule? And then it was like, no, wait a minute, you wouldn't. Of course, you wouldn't fall.
We're on the float.
That was really neat. So many neat. I just love that. And that's, again, is one of those moments that you're only going to get on a show like The Expanse that actually cares about science.
Well, and when Kotiar was going down and Avasarala was watching his broadcast and unable to speak to him.
Yeah.
The cruelty of that moment on the part of the writers, really, was also really delightful. That was delightful from our end.
Well, and Nick had come to us and asked, I think actually on set he came up to me and said, I really want to say something that it's like I'm talking to Avasarala. I want to have that last moment with her. And I said, okay, but you don't know she's watching. And there's no way for you to know she's watching. So it's going to feel a little false. And so he and I talked about it for a while, and then I went and talked to Noreen. And the two of us kicked around some ideas, and what we came up with was, actually what we want there is we want to reconnect the two of them, but not make it so specific as if he's like sending a message to her. So that's where the line, so Sharon Paul, I guess this makes us even, because of course Sharon Paul was Avasarala's son who died,
mm-hmm.
who right. Kotiar had worked with and, last season had said, I'm here because I owe him, so I'm protecting his mother. So, you know, he always felt guilty that he got Sharon Paul killed, and now he's dying, you know, trying to save people. So by bringing her son up and saying, I did all this for you because I feel guilty about what happened to you, and now I think we're even, that was a way to connect him back to Avasarala and have that moment between the two of them. But as Daniel was saying, the cruelty of the writers, it is the cruelest version of that because it's a reminder of why he was there and why he felt guilty and what he thought he was doing.
And that he still dies alone.
And then he still dies alone.
Yeah.
But heroically. There's a sliver of hope. Yeah.
No, not hope. Just heroism. That's
right. That's what I meant.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was a good death.
Absolutely. That was a good death. Let's talk about Nick a little bit because, I mean, we never got a chance to talk to him on the show. And, you know, now this is his swan song. I'm assuming not going to, it's kind of hard to recover from a total reactor explosion.
Well, especially when you have your cheek right against it when it goes.
Yeah.
It seems unlikely. But
yeah, so unlikely he'll return. What was it about his, I guess, you know, as you were casting this part and everything, what was it about his performance that really, or I guess his audition that really struck you and made you say, this guy is the guy to play Cotillard?
I wasn't there for that part. I came in when it was dailies.
I liked his audition a lot. Noreen and I actually went back and forth on this a lot. Noreen, so Nick is pretty subtle. He can be a pretty subtle actor, and Noreen wasn't sure if he was exactly what we were looking for. We all knew he was a really good actor. I mean, all of us had seen him in all the other stuff he had done, so there was no question that he had the chops. But Noreen just wasn't sure, like, is he going to play well with Sho Ray? And, you know, so he wasn't quite sure. So I emailed my friend Liam McIntyre, who played Spartacus on the Starz show Spartacus, which, of course, Nick was on, played a character named Asher. And I just emailed him and said, hey, what do you think of Nick? Did you like working with him? And Liam immediately wrote back and said, yeah, he's great. He's a total pro. You know, he's good on set. You won't regret working with him. So I just went to Noreen and said, look, here's the report from Liam. And that was enough. So Noreen was like, all right, yeah, let's go with this guy. And we were everybody was really glad that we did, because everything Liam said turned out to be true. Nick's a total pro. He's great on set. He's great on camera. The subtlety that he brings to some of his performance was exactly what we needed. It turned out to be a positive, not a negative. Because, you know, he didn't feel like... Sho Ray is a very powerful actress on screen, and it doesn't feel like she's rolling over the top of him. They feel like equals. As hard as it was to cast that part, we really got lucky with who we picked.
And I think there was a lot... they talk about chemistry. They talk about the thing where it's you put two people together and then something else happens. And I think Sho Ray and Nick, and then later Frankie Bobby came in, and there was a real charm in those three together that was more than any one performance.
Yeah, and I think it's, speaking to what Ty said, it's great because they all do hold their own with each other, but in very different ways.
Yeah.
You know, it's Avasarala has a certain demeanor, and Cotillard doesn't rise to that level in terms of intensity, but it's all there, you know, like you said, the subtlety of his performance. I love, my favorite types of characters are these absolute badasses who don't feel like they have to show off that they're an absolute badass at all times. They just are. And mm-hmm. I felt like that was the kind of character that he was.
Well, it's interesting because he was that, and Bobby was that, and them coming to a place where they recognized that in each other and were good with it that's the arc of their relationship. I mean, if you remember the interaction between them last season, where Nick was trying to kind of figure out what she was and whether she was trustworthy, and in retrospect was figuring out whether or not to sneak her power armor onto the Guan Xian. That's what he was doing that whole time. Was testing her to see whether his gut was to trust her, and now here they are, and they have that. I love that arc. It's a small one. It's subtle. It's easy to miss, and it's just delightful.
Yeah, yeah. So we're all pouring one out for Cotillard today, because that is a character who it was sad to see go. On the other hand. Let's talk about somebody who it was not so sad to see go, I guess. Obviously, returning down, now we travel down from the Agatha King. Although, also, we should mention Gwyn, who is now gone. And that whole character, I mean, a shorter time in terms of on-screen time, I would say, but still made a huge impact, obviously. And his whole... Man, I was with Alex. I would have been happy to see him shut up in that last scene on the bridge, but I guess it's more true to life that he would get his chance to say his word.
The thing that's interesting to me about Wynn and Cotillard is that they both feel like they're having heroic deaths. Wynn believes he is dying in the cause of righteousness. He believes he is on the side of angels. Just as much as Cotillard does, just as much as anyone. It's just that Wynn is responding to and reacting to a different slice of the world than Cotillard is.
Yeah. He and really just certain all the way to the very end that he was doing the right thing.
Yep. No, he does not have a moment of doubt.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's gone too. We won't pour one out for him, but because he shot Southern, that made me mad.
Yeah, no, but that was that was angry making. That's true.
That was uncool. Ultimately, trying to also wipe out life on Mars, also probably not a great.
All he did was shoot a bunch of chemical biological weapons at Mars. I mean,
right? Like, what's you
like
know,
we hey, all haven't done that.
Exactly. What's a little planetary genocide, but. So he's gone. And then also the one I was getting to from the very beginning when I started that little segue, we saw the end of Strickland now, which that this whole segment on Io, I'm kind of jumping around in terms of the timeline of the episode.
I think it's fair to assume that people have seen it before they start talking to us. Yeah, that's not a problem.
If you haven't, sorry, because we've been spoiling things.
Oh, my God, like, just all over the place. Just everything. Just... Might as well not watch the episode now.
Yeah, but no. So we finally see the Rossi crew catch up with Jules Pierre Mao, catch up with Dr. Strickland, and
all of that work we did building in Praxis growing darkness and the yes. violence in his that's where we went with it.
Yeah. It was really.
Did you think Praxis was going to shoot him? As a viewer, did you think Prax was going to do the thing?
Yes, I did.
All right.
I thought it was coming. I mean, I thought it would be a struggle and there would be that moment of drawn out tension. But at the end of the day, I thought he was going to pull the trigger.
And how did it feel when he didn't?
Awesome. Only because of how it happened.
Well, so I'm going to take credit for that. I think Amos's final line there is the most Amos line in the 36 episodes of the show, and I wrote that one.
Nice. So, yes. Yeah, that was a mic drop moment if I've ever seen one.
Ty does the best Amos.
it's funny because
we're talking about.
Go ahead. No, do it.
Oh, I was just setting it up. I mean, we have them catch up with Strickland. Prax is going to necessarily shoot him. Amos stops him. You're not that guy. I when he said you're not that guy, I knew the next line was coming, but that made it no less satisfying, honestly.
Yeah. You were going to say?
I was just going to say Wes and I worked together very well and he kind of became accustomed to the idea that if he didn't like something in a script that Amos was doing, he would come talk to me and ask if there was another way to do it. And it got by the season three, we got this shorthand where he would just walk up and he would go, "Have you done an Amos pass on this script yet?" When a new script went out. So that one I was very proud of because I did an Amos pass on that script and he got it. And first thing he said is, he was like, "Oh yeah, I can tell you did the Amos in this one because all the Amos lines are right." So
one of the things that has been amazing to me through this whole process is the degree to which all of those scripts are collaborative.
Yeah.
There are scripts regardless of who the credit is to on it, everybody is in there. Everybody is in all of them. It was amazing to me. I mean, there are some of my best lines are not in scripts that I wrote, and some of the best lines in my scripts aren't mine. So I'm really grateful to the writing crew and to Narain and to Mark and Hawk and to everybody who were able to share that well to work on
that. That's absolutely right. It's something we don't talk about a lot, but you were talking about that last moment between Sorrento Gillis and Aaron Wright. Daniel wrote that scene because it became very clear in the writer's room that Daniel was our guy who writes speeches. So pretty much every speech in the show, regardless of who wrote the episode, is written by Daniel. He's the guy who takes the speech pass.
And that was a great speech, too.
Yeah. So we all tried it. Alan, who wrote the first draft of that script, had written a version of that scene. Everybody agreed it wasn't quite right. Noreen took a pass at it and tried it. It wasn't quite right. He asked me to take a pass on it. I took a pass on it. It didn't work. And then finally, Noreen asked Daniel to take a swing at it, and that's the scene that's actually in the show. So a lot of the episodes have that kind of process to them where, everybody's taking a swing at a certain problematic moment.
And then we wind up with the best one, and that's what we run with.
Yeah.
I have to imagine it's incredibly satisfying for you guys as writers to have a moment like that, or have a moment like Amos's big line here, and write it and think, oh, that's good, and then see it
and it's like
realized on screen as like a total slam dunk. That must be a really satisfying feeling.
Well, the thing that's actually the nicest for me, the thing that makes me, even when it's not that moment, the thing that actually gets me happiest is when the line reading in my head and the line reading that the actor uses match. Even if it's not a climactic moment, it's just the moment when my imagination and their imagination are running in harness is actually really rare. There are so many things that I have written here that the pronunciation or the emphasis or what it meant to the actor was slightly different from what it meant to me. And what they did was great. And the scenes that they put together are wonderful. But that moment of consonance when I know we're all exactly on the same wavelength is that's rare and wonderful.
Is that something that that developed over the course of the three seasons as you got to know the actors better and they got to know their characters better? Did you feel that happening more often?
I don't know.
No, because it's not about the actor not understanding with the intent. It's about the fact that it's a collaboration and the actor is bringing their piece of the performance, their interpretation of it, their spin on it, and it doesn't always line up with what the writer
imagined
in their head. But that doesn't mean the actor is doing it wrong.
Right.
That's often their version is right.
It felt more like it feels more less like they understood me and more like, ooh, I got it right.
Yeah. So Ty, how high was the high five that Wes gave you when he read that line, like for the first time?
I don't know.
it's a great badass line. It's so good. It was like, again, seeing Strickland die is great and satisfying because of all the horrible things that he's done. But to have it done that way that was just pure action hero mic drop line delivery. It was so good.
Well, more than any, it's kind of an action hero moment, but more than anything, the thing I love about it is that when Amos loves somebody, the thing that he has to offer them is that he will commit murder for them. So Amos likes Prax and wants to protect Prax. And the way that he does that is he stops Prax from committing a murder because he knows that will weigh on Prax. He knows Prax has a conscience. He knows
it'll darken and he won't recover.
Exactly. He'll still be thinking about it later. Amos knows he can murder a dude and forget that he did it 2 seconds later. He doesn't care at all. So that is how he shows Prax that he loves him is, look, you're about to commit a murder. I know this is going to bother you. Why don't you just go ahead and leave the room? I'll commit the murder. and we'll all be happy.
I think they should put that on a Hallmark card somewhere. That's a really touching. No, but it's true. I mean, that is, he did save Prax from a really dark place. So,
and just happens to be the place where he lives. It's like,
right.
Yeah. Amos knows he's going to be fine. He didn't care.
Yeah. It's not going to be anything new for him.
My other great Amos moment for this episode, though, is, of course, when he's introduced to May. That's such a it's just so funny seeing, big, murderous Amos interacting with a small child like that. That was a really fun moment.
Yeah, and when Prax is explaining who Amos is.
Yeah.
And Amos is like, oh, that's who we are. Oh, right. Yeah. And that's, it's a, and Amos has been at sea for so long. I mean, he's been kind of without that, human connection since Naomi's news came out at the end of last season. Wes is amazing because there are times when he will, the camera's on him and he will barely do anything and it will be profound.
Yeah.
That's one of those. I love that scene a lot.
Yeah. And it's almost like it's easy to forget given who Amos is, that he does have like a complex emotional life and cares for people on some level. And it's always nice to have those little moments where you're reminded of that.
Yeah. He's just, not like other people.
But yeah, and I gotta admit, as someone who catches feels pretty easily, the reunion between Prax and May was really, really beautiful. Gosh, that was a great payoff.
And you know, you've been through the show up till now. You know that it's also entirely possible that we would kill her.
Yeah, right.
It could have gone either way. It wasn't like, oh well, you know. Surely they will, you know, we are capable of tremendous cruelty.
Sure. When Strickland left the kids in the airlock, at first I was sure he was going to space them.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. I mean, I know you guys are cruel, but spacing an airlock full of kids would have been a whole new level.
It would not be the first child we've blown into space.
No, yeah, it wouldn't even be a new level. It would be kind of the same level we've been doing every now and again since the start.
Right, right.
I mean, you remember that?
I'm glad.
Father and child floating in the emptiness of space. We're terrible people.
I had blocked that out. But I will admit I was very happy to see that part of the story have a happy ending, and their whole, you know, him tucking her in and reuniting her with her bear. It was just like, sweet, and especially given the dark road we've been seeing Prax go down this season and kind of the how dead he seemed a little bit compared to the person he was when we first met him, to see that part of him basically come back to life, was really touching.
And I had somebody online ask me why the backpack? Why did she carry the backpack, and why has Prax been lugging that backpack around? And you finally get to see why. It's because she had her stuffy in it.
Yeah.
And he's been carrying it this whole time. In case he finds her, she's going to want that back.
Yeah, that was really, oh gosh, so nice. And again, in a show that can be very cruel.
Speaking of Katoa.
Yes.
I mean, we murdered the hell out of that kid. He was completely innocent. He was a nice kid. He was,
yeah.
I mean, horribly used and eventually murdered by one of our favorite people. I mean, that's a little rough.
I know, and that was a moment where you cheer, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, that's actually really tragic.
Yeah.
So my one question about this. So moving to this other part of Aya, we have Bobby in her confrontation with the Katoa hybrid. Being chased through the base, which was really, really cool from an effects standpoint. Just all the platforming, so to speak. I couldn't help but think, you know, if this was the 80s, we'd have a nice NES level of the Expanse game.
With some jumping puzzles?
Exactly, exactly. But so that whole segment was really cool. And then, just very, you know, Bobby down on power, laying out on her back. That was just a very tense moment. And the one question I did have, I didn't see what distracted Katoa in the moment before she killed him.
It's just being outside. It's, you know, Jupiter is off in the background and the stars.
Yeah. The beauty of the universe was what killed him.
Oh man, 'twas beauty that killed the beast.
I'm exactly. Just saying, this goes back to the heart-wrenchingly cruel.
Well, that makes it worse. Great.
It's sort of like if Fay Wray had a minigun strapped to her arm and used that to kill King Kong.
Yeah.
Right. That's just, I think that's they're when they reboot, they're going to go down that road. But yeah, and that whole sequence, I mean, it was from an effects standpoint, was really great because it was some of the most seamless, I think, cutting between a CGI model and an actual actor that I've seen on TV before. Because obviously, you know, some of the longer shots of Bobby were, I would assume, CGI. You guys didn't actually construct a giant base and have her jumping from.
Well, we didn't.
Most of that exterior base stuff was real.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it turned out there was this. I don't remember what it was when it was alive.
It's a power plant.
This derelict power plant.
Yeah, it's like an old coal fired power plant
right across from where we were from the sound stages. So, yeah, it was like, well, we just have to take the stuff across the road, and there's this awesome ruined place with all these amazing visuals.
Oh, that's very cool. I would have assumed it was all fake. There you go.
No, that was real stuff. We were running cameras around all through there. And so, you know, things like Bobby jumping from girder to girder, we actually had cameras on wires, like kind of the way they originally shot Spider-Man. Back in the rainy days where they would hang cameras from wires and swing them through the city to get those great swinging shots. We had that kind of rig set up. So we had cameras sort of zooming through to get Bobby's POV shots where she's jumping from girder to girder. Yeah, but all that stuff was real. It's only when you sort of look out through the girders and see Io and space outside, that is all, of course, a visual effect. But right. Whenever the camera's pointed the other direction, and you've got those amazing like girders and wires hanging out. That's all real stuff.
I have to assume that was an incredibly complex sequence to shoot and produce, just in terms of the whole choreography of the chase and figuring out where the cameras were going to be and everything like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it's Jeff Wolno is the director. And the reason that Noreen selected Jeff to shoot that is because Jeff is unflappable. He's a TV director who's been working for a very, very long time. He's directed 2 episodes a season for us every season. And we tend to give him our most technically complex episodes because he just never panics. And we gave him one day to shoot everything he needed to shoot in that incredible set, you know, that old derelict power plant. And he just went and shot the shit out of it. You know, our camera crew was 40 feet off the ground on these shaky platforms and we had wires swinging around and all the crazy stuff going on. And Jeff just calmly shoots everything he needs and it all cuts together. So, yeah, give Jeff credit for that one.
It was really super. I mean, just super exciting to watch. And then, you know, again, given that the hybrid has repeatedly gotten up from being shot, even when Bobby shot him in the head, to have that moment where you don't quite know if it worked or not, was really a nice little added bit of tension, I think.
Yeah, no, that was and it's such, you know, the way that it was built from the books, this was the end of Caliban's War. This was the response to that fight that we didn't exactly ever see in season 2.
Right.
This is the one where, you know, we saw something coming and then we cut back to Bobby and everybody was dead. And for her, this has all been that one fight. This is all kind of coming back to that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And she gets the, I guess revenge on a certain level, but at least I would say almost satisfaction of knowing she can.
I'm thinking
she's not
closure. I think this is a good place for closure. That's the word.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of closure and things turning out better, another aspect was the kind of the reunion of the Rossi family in full, I would say, for those of us who are Noldenites, huge payoff at the end there. I was, you know, I would have settled for a kiss, but instead we get more space nudity, which was awesome.
But did you hear what they said?
Yes. Which of course, once again, you guys in this episode, it's like, oh, that's very satisfying, but there's this little other screw to turn. So we hear Naomi's leaving, I guess. He says she's not, Holden says she's not staying, which kind of makes the whole moment very bittersweet.
Right.
And I mean, is there, I'm assuming this is her leaving to deal with some of the background information we've learned about her having to do with her son and, the elements she was involved with in the belt, which those of us in the books know, who've read the books know, there's a lot going on there. So, it'd be interesting to see where that goes for the remainder of the season.
Yeah. One of the really interesting changes that got made when we translated this thing onto the screen was, kind of the identity issue of being a belter and of being, identifying yourself with your people and your tribe, and how Naomi has embodied that in the show in a way that she doesn't really ever quite do in the books, or at least not as explicitly. And that, I think Dominique has really, done a great job with that aspect of Naomi.
Yeah. But even still, it was great to see her, you know, buy into her family and the Rossi again in a big way by making it, you know, she has this plan of what she can do for the belt, but she wouldn't have done it if everybody hadn't voted, you know, to do it, which was a definite switch from what we saw with the giving the protomolecule to Fred Johnson. So,
and then everybody voted to do it. I mean, everybody had her back, which, so there's, there's, for all the people who've been waiting to see that repaired, there's that moment. There's the moment when they're all backing her again.
And it is, it's one of those things where, you know, a selfish part of me throughout the season is like, come on, guys, just get it back together, get it back together. But I think having drawn it out as much as you guys did over the course of these episodes, and given, I don't even want to say drawn it out because that makes it sound like it was, didn't need to be that long. I felt like making it as much of an arc that took as long as it did made it all the more A, real, and B, satisfying when it actually did pay off.
I was thinking meaningful. Meaningful is a good word for that.
Meaningful is a great word for that as well. Thank you. You've got all the words. I do. I don't have words.
It's funny. It's like they pay me for that.
I know. It's like you're some kind of right person. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't get excited.
But, and, you know, also the other big loose end tied up here, Jules Pierre-Mao, now brought to justice and made to not only face Avassarala, but kneel in front of Avassarala, which was a, I was not expecting that. And that was just like, what a gut wrenching moment for him to have to do that, I would imagine.
Yep.
And so
screw him too. Yeah.
Strickland and JPM get it. So, and then of course, all of this is great. Everyone's happy. We've saved the children. The bad guys have paid. The war is going to be over. But oh yeah, there's Venus.
Right.
And the way that was done in this episode, I was, again, as someone who knew this was coming, I was really curious about how that moment of the revelation of the work was going to be handled on the show. It was interesting to me that it was kind of handled through a news broadcast. We didn't get to see it ourselves. And, but the visual representation of it, like as this blister basically blossoming off of the face of Venus, was really, really compelling. And obviously we are entering a new chapter in this story with the revelation of what that is. And well, obviously we don't know exactly what it is, but that it is some sort of giant structure.
Something going to happen. You know, something going on.
So let's talk a bit about that and the decision, I guess, to kind of have it appear on background as you know, while we're having this happy ending denouement, we get reminded that there's this other big giant thing going on.
It's exactly what you just said. I don't know.
There you go. Okay.
Well done. Yes. No. The protomolecule, and all of the things that we've been seeing with the hybrids and Eros and Ganymede, and that's all been people who found this thing and who are experimenting with it and trying to control it and trying to remake it into our own image. And this is the first time, really, that we've seen it doing whatever it's up to. Because it came in here with its own agenda from the beginning. And people have tried to sidetrack it and co-opt it and use it toward their own ends. And the protomolecule has never given a crap about any of that. It's doing what it's been doing. And this is kind of the fruition of that. We don't know what it is yet. I mean, I know what it is yet. You know what it is yet. But
yeah,
someone who hasn't seen next week doesn't know what it is yet.
When it came to the design of this thing, how were you guys involved in deeply in that, or you know, the visual actual look of what it's going to look like?
I mean, a little bit. I talked to Bob, the visual effects supervisor, about it a little bit early on. But Tim and Ryan, I think, did some concept. We have a couple of fantastic concept artists who do, concept art for almost everything that we develop on the show, and they did some concept art. And I talked to them a little bit about it, but I think it's mostly Tim and Ryan and it's Bob. The three of them have to take all the credit on that one.
Yeah, I think we said something like it looks sort of like a giant squid coming up, and then this happened. And it's not a whole lot of guidance from us, but
you're happy with the way it turned out.
Oh,
well, the big thing that I repeated to all three of those guys is that, and Noreen, I think, was saying the same thing. So the two of us, the thing we kept saying to the guys on set was, mechanical and biological at the same time. It has to look like a biological thing that somebody built out of machine parts. And I think that's what we got. It looks like kind of big sea creature, but it just happens to be built out of like machinery.
And actually this might be a longer discussion, but even as I was reading the books, this idea of a molecular agent as the tool of alien contact and alien invasion. When you guys were conceiving these books in the first place, where did that come from? Is that something that,
from Ty.
Okay.
So
Ty.
I mean, nanotech has been around in sci-fi for a very long time. So that's not a new concept. That's not something I invented. But I wrote a short story a long time ago that included a scene where somebody is in Africa and they're dealing with an Ebola outbreak. And so I did a bunch of research on Ebola. And I think the combination of those two things is what stuck in my head is that, because Ebola is incredibly infectious. And if you get infected and you don't get treated, the virus turns you into basically a walking zombie that just vomits Ebola infection on everyone around you. So that's why the infection can pass so quickly. A village gets infected, one person gets infected, and by the end of the month, the entire village is dead. That's what makes it so deadly. And so the idea that if you were going to send something to another, because it's really hard to move things from star system to star system, with the whole speed of light thing. So if you were going to send something to another star system, you would want to send something tiny. You would want to send something that reproduces itself. And then once it's reproduced itself, builds whatever you want it to build. And so it was just the combination of those things, sort of the nanotech that has the infectious properties of Ebola. And then once there's enough of it, starts building the thing that you want it to build. I think that's where it kind of all came from.
That's really cool. Yeah. And which we don't know what that thing is yet. I mean, some of us do.
It's a big robot squid.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Because who doesn't want one of those?
The aliens love robot squids, and their purpose is to put a robot squid in every solar system.
That was the end game of this entire arc with the protomolecule.
Now there's just a robot squid that swims around in our solar system, and that's it.
And it has and now it is aesthetically more pleasing to the aliens, and it was art. It was an art project.
It's an art project.
It was really there was this alien consciousness that was really trying to get its MFA, and now we're here.
We're just raw materials for the great performance art of the universe, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah, that's true in fiction or not.
In many senses.
That's not us. That's the world.
All right. And on that note, that was episode 306, Immolation. We want to hear what you guys have to say about it. In a minute, we're going to be talking to Dominique Tipper. But before, a.k.a. Naomi Nagata, who's joining us for an interview. But before we do, we got to do our shout outs, which we do every week, where we shout out something that we're into this particular week. So whoever wants to start with that, please go ahead.
I started playing Battletech after you told me to play.
Ooh. What are your thoughts?
It's a lot of fun. It's a little... I find, because I've been playing a lot of console games, I find long load times very frustrating.
Yes, that is true.
So, and it does have some long load times. But, you know, I mean, it definitely gives me that feeling of playing Mech Commander back in the day. So, yeah, it's cool.
And hopefully they're going to continue to work on optimization to kind of reduce some of that. So,
oh, yeah, that'd be great.
There will be less waiting in the future. Daniel, how about you?
Well, I'm actually going to call it a mystery writer. Tana French wrote In the Woods, I think was her first one. It was years ago. And it was a kind of a controversial mystery at the time. She's an Irish-American writer. Her stuff is set in Ireland. And the first one she did was just punk. It was an amazingly brave thing to do in a first book, and I admired her deeply for it. And I've been following her on and off ever since, and recently read one of her most recent, was called The Trespasser, and it's wonderful to have an artist who you see their early work and it's really good, and then every single thing they do after that just gets better. Watching her really master the craft and really master story and turn into somebody who I'm just kind of hungry for the next thing that she does has been a pleasure. Especially considering the number of people who I really liked the first thing they did, and then everything after that was kind of a disappointment. She's not that one. She's awesome. So, first one is In the Woods. The most recent one is The Trespasser. Everything in between is fascinating and better and better and better as she goes. So,
very cool. And all right. And my shout out for this week is going to be the Bohemian Rhapsody trailer, which I just watched today for the upcoming film about Queen, the glam rock band, which is a band that I have long championed, despite the fact that many people think they're cheesy, but I think they're awesome. And Rami Malek.
Name three people who think they're cheesy.
Name three people who
we
don't.
Will find them and throw them under a bus.
Queen is one of the most musically relevant bands
ever
in rock history.
Ever.
Yeah, so to call them glam rock is I mean, yeah, Freddie Mercury was fabulous, but don't hold that against him. He was still one of the greatest rock singers of all time.
Yes.
Oh, I was not using glam rock as a pejorative.
No,
by the way.
No.
You can apply that to Bowie. You can apply that to a lot of stuff that's really, really good. So, yeah. But Rami Malek from Mr. Robot is playing Freddie Mercury. And
he's amazing.
Yeah, in the trailer, he looks amazing. And the guy who they got to play Brian May, whose name I don't know off the top of my head, sounds dead on like Brian May and looks dead on like Brian May.
I thought that was just Brian May.
I know, right? It's like they plucked him from his time stream and dropped him into this movie. But it'll be interesting to see, because I know there was some back and forth about how deeply involved the actual band was going to be in the movie and whether that would kind of dull or soften some of the edges that they might otherwise have been on it. But I mean, the trailer was exciting as hell, and I'm really looking forward. As a fan of the band, I'm really looking forward to seeing that movie. So that's Bohemian Rhapsody, and this was episode 306 with Ty and Daniel. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, and we will come back every episode until this is cooked. We'll
Excellent.
Be here.
Thank you so much, and for anyone listening, please stick around for a chat with Dominique Tipper. Coming up right now.
So hi, Dom. Welcome back to The Churn.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going.
Yeah, it's an interesting time for the show.
It is.
Obviously, as I was speaking with Ty and Daniel earlier, you know, about the fact that Sci-Fi is not picking up the fourth season, but there's still hope out there. I guess, what's that experience been like for you? Obviously not great news, but I guess the outpouring of fan support and the effort to save the show has been really inspiring. How's that been for you?
Yes, it's been equal parts, like, devastating because, you know, these guys, especially the Rosie crew, are my family. Like, we've worked together for 4 years now, and we put our heart and soul into this show, and it just seems a shame that the best sci-fi show in 10 years, as it is frequently talked about, is being cancelled. You know, I try to put a positive spin on everything, and I'm very much like, okay, if this is what it is, and then that's what it is, we go on to something else. But it is devastating in this case, because, like, our showrunner, Narena, said, like, it's rare that you're on a show where everything clicks, like, and everything clicks on this show. You know, we all like working together. We all like being in each other's company. The writing is excellent. The show is excellent. The story is excellent. The source material is excellent. So
the acting's okay.
The acting's average, you know. I mean, no, I'm not talking about myself. Yeah, no, I mean, sure. But it's just one of those things where I feel like it feels like it's a shame. And that's devastating. But I am shocked at the outpouring. Like, I go onto Twitter and I cannot get through my mentions because it is just full of fans supporting the show and expressing their outrage. And I find it quite overwhelming, actually, that, you know, this is like the moment when you really see people love the show as much as you love making it. Like, it's bizarre, but also wonderful. So, yeah, I feel kind of shitty for everyone that we don't get to give them more.
Has there been you're one of the more active cast members on social media. Has there been a particular interaction with a fan in the wake of all this that you found particularly moving?
I mean, so when I heard the news, I just posted like a kind of statement-ish thing saying that, you know, I've loved playing this character and I'm sorry we don't get to give you any more. And I've just never had a tweet that's been so liked and retweeted in my life. So it was nice that in that moment, it kind of received that kind of attention, because I know people love the show, but you don't really see it until something ends, you know, like this ends.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, no. And I just, there's like thousands of likes and retweets and I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, that's kind of, I mean, I get mentions every day of people going like, we're going to save The Expanse, renew The Expanse, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it's kind of overwhelming. It's such a beloved show.
Yeah. And there's still hope out there, you know, for something to happen. And in the meantime, we've got the rest of season three.
More importantly, we have the rest of season three. And we haven't even got into like the stuff. Like, I'm like, we're just warming up.
I know, that was, I was saying that to Ty and Daniel earlier. It's like we get to all this closure with a lot of things on Io, on and around Io, and then suddenly it's like, oh yeah, there's a whole big other thing happening.
Oh yeah,
to come.
There's characters we haven't met and locations we haven't been to, and it's just this back end of the show is my favorite. So
oh, wow.
I hope. Even though the news is shitty, I hope that this kind of back end of the season is rewarding because, oh, it's great. It's so good.
Yeah, and it's been a particularly interesting season for Naomi.
Given Hasn't it?
The fallout from her decision having to do with giving the protomolecule to the OPA, yes. Or to Fred Johnson, I should say, to the belt. Can you talk a bit about that arc and what it's been like developing that over the course of the past six episodes?
Yeah, I think that actually in this season, it's been a nice, because I feel like I've spent two seasons really like not being able to indulge in her backstory. You know, I've like wanted to keep it subtle and not hint at it too much, but I knew that we were building up to this. So I think this season is really about Naomi identifying with her belterness, if that is a term. And so it feels like the kind of peak of everything I've been working towards over the past couple of seasons. And I mean, it, like I say, the back end of the season is my favorite for a reason. And it's because I feel like we fully go into that arc and we really start to develop it and see, oh, I almost said a spoiler then. See Naomi in a different light. So, yeah, I just found it really exciting and really refreshing and something different from what's been in the past couple of seasons. I can't say any more than that.
I know. It's really hard because having read the books, I know some of what's coming with Naomi's backstory, or at least some of the, you know, the broader strokes. I so want to get into that with you.
No, I know, but I actually think that this is, oh my God, I'm not sure I can say that, but I think it's a little departure, a little bit.
Oh. Well, at the very least, it's kind of...
That's as much as I'll say.
Yeah, I think it's pushed forward, because I know at this point in the books, we don't know the identity of... we don't know the name of Naomi's son, or the whole, you know, her kind of backstory there, so...
Sure.
Again, I'm also kind of skirting around what I can and can't say.
No, but yeah, this is more to do with her identity.
Oh, so, okay.
You guys will see when you keep watching, but
right.
It gets really good from here. Like, just delicious stuff to play. And yeah, I love this season for her. I just love what she goes through. Yeah.
I mean, in particular, you know, as someone who's been following the show, watching that at family, the Rossi family basically fracture and spend most of the past six episodes patching it back together has been, I would say, hard, but also rewarding, you know, in the way that it's kind of taken its time and you see these pieces come back together. Can you talk a bit about that aspect? And I guess, you know, you mentioned that you guys are kind of almost a family, having worked together as long as you have. What it was like playing that drifting apart with people who you've kind of become family with?
Yeah, it was really hard, actually. The whole kind of first five and six episodes, I just kept making jokes. I was like, okay, guys, I know you're angry. I know I fucked up. But, you know, it's... okay, so, like, because there's been lots of debates about this with the fans and stuff as well, like, on Twitter. And... you know, initially when I got the first couple of scripts, I was like, this is not hard enough. This is not consequential enough. Like, Naomi has torn her family apart, whether you agree with what she'd done or not. The fact is, the ramifications of her actions are that she's torn her family apart. And I just didn't feel like the consequences were harsh enough. So when we first started kind of workshopping the scenes, I was like, this needs to be harder for her. Like, she can't just do that and then waltz back in and everyone's okay. So we really developed as a group, you know, what that would feel like. Like, if Dominique went and done something between the four of us that no one agreed with, or that I'd kind of said I was going to do something else and then went and done the opposite thing, like, what would that feel like? And it's devastating when anyone's trust gets betrayed in that way, whether it's with a partner, whether someone cheats on you. That's what it feels like to the Rossi crew. So for us, we really wanted to delve into the personal, very personal consequences of her actions between the four of us and how each person responds to that, how Alex responds to that, how Amos responds to that, how Holden responds to that. Like, it's going to be different. And what does that mean? And how does Naomi take it? Does she think she's right? Like, And then the mix of Avasarala and Bobby coming onto the ship, and then it still being that way, and we having to introduce these new people into our mix. And so, you know, we worked a lot on the dynamic of what all that would mean and what it looked like. So it is harsh, like, and she doesn't get a break, because that's what happens when you betray your family. And so there is a let up to it. But so far, no one has guessed what that will be. Like, everyone's been kind of going on, well, it's either going to be this and this or this and this. And I was talking to Daniel about it, and we was both saying, like, it's so funny how no one's actually got what is going to happen. Mm-hmm. No one's got it yet. So I'd be interested to see the reaction to what actually happens. Which I think
The other interesting aspect of all of this, you know, you mentioned the betrayal and the breaking of the family, and then being trapped in a tin can with these people in the middle of space.
Which is the other thing. I was like, you know, you can't just say, in Naomi's case, get up and leave. Like, that's not an option. I'm not just going to blast off into space in a suit. Like, so there was also that added thing of, like, you know, for want of a better term, like, having to sit in your shit. Like, you do these things and you have to really live with them. And I found that interesting, because as the life that I live here on Earth, you know, if I want to walk away from something, I can. And if I don't want to deal with the ramifications of my actions, I may have to verbally, but I can still walk away from it. So that was an interesting thing to play with, of that she is like, became like a ghost on the ship, because no one wanted to interact with her anymore or give her the time of day. And I think that's what also led to her being so, like, trying to patch it up, because you're, like you say, you're in a tin can with these people, and every day the nature of what you've done is forced in your face when you go to the galley or when you walk on deck, or can't get away from it. So that was interesting as well, and I had that in the back of my head a lot, because it was quite easy to forget, because that's not how it is on Earth.
Right. I think the scene that most drove that home for me was when Holden, I think, has decided that he wants to go to Io to save May. And he's just, and Naomi keeps trying to object, and he's just railroading right over her. How hard was that scene to play
that
on your part?
That was hard. And I actually was like, Stephen, can we have a hug afterwards? Because it's just brutal, you know, like, with acting, it's like, okay, it's acting, but in the moment, if you want to make it honest, it's real in the moment, and it feels horrible. And, you know, especially in that scene, everyone kind of goes, yeah, fuck you, Naomi, fuck you, we're going to Io. And it was just a bit like, okay, guys, okay, cool. And I just, again, ramifications of her actions, like, you can't just do that. Even though I know she believes she'd done the right thing and she will stick by it. But there's consequences to that. Someone gets the fire, do you know what I mean? And in this case, it was the Rosie crew.
Yeah, it almost would have been better, I feel like, if they had argued with her, but everybody was just kind of ignoring her at that point.
It's worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the rage everyone feels about it.
So we're six episodes in now. We've just cleared up basically all the business on Io. What is there a scene that jumps out at you from this particular batch of episodes as either your favorite or one that was particularly challenging to do?
To be honest, I didn't love it in the moment, but I love the result of the scene between Avasarala and Naomi in the galley.
Oh yeah.
When they square up to each other and kind of, you know, I know what you're doing. Yeah, but I know what you're doing. Like, and I adore Sheree. Like, she's like my second mum. So it was really weird to switch off and have to be like, you're my people's oppressor personified, and you're in front of me on my ship. Like, to switch the stakes to that. That was quite a lot for me, because I love her. So that was quite hard, but also I liked that these two, like, Titan women were, like, going at each other, like, at each other's intelligence. Like, I loved it. But to be honest, overall, like, there's a scene in, like, the first episode where Alex and Amos are working on the thing where the protomolecule was, and Naomi mm-hmm. comes down the ladder and he's using, like, a grinder, and she's trying to talk to them over it, and Amos just carries on grinding, and she's like, guys, we need to go to Tycho. And then it kind of stops and everyone's like, no. Like, that was really hard to shoot. That was stressful on my system, because it was like a real situation. But all those scenes were testing, but also I feel necessary for the arc. And I did feel a little bit like, oh, like, guys, can we just, you know, as Dominique, but...
Yeah, it's
a hard first half of the season. We're not even halfway through, but first five eps. So yeah, that's kind of how I feel about that.
So it was this season is all about the emotional challenges. You didn't have to do, you know, any major spacewalks or anything like that, but
no,
it's all
really.
Been about that. Yeah,
I mean, there's a few things coming up actually that I had to do, some stunt sequences. Zero-G stunt sequences, but they were more in power, which have a different take on them. But yeah, there's a few things of Naomi coming up in Zero-G, which are really cool, but not in this first bit.
Yeah, no, the emotional stunt work was all the first bit.
Yes. I mean, there's still a lot of emotional stunt work, but... she gets a little break over the next few episodes.
All right. So what, you know, obviously the relationship with Amos was a big one for Naomi at the beginning, and that felt like it completely fractured at the beginning of this season. Can you speak a bit to that? And I guess working with Wes on that particular, I guess, divergence is a word for it?
Yeah. I think that out of all her relationships on the Rosie, that was the one that suffered the most, because Amos is so black and white. And I think once you go down in his estimation, it's very hard for him to reason or come back from it. So I think for out of all the relationships, that is the one. And to be honest, you don't really see it unless you're looking for it. But that's the one that suffers the most, because Amos is done with Naomi. He's like, you are not who I thought you were. You're not my guiding light anymore. She doesn't have his respect anymore. So that was me and Wes talked about that a lot, because we're like, what does this look like? Like, is he just shut down? And he is. So I think out of the three guys on the ship, he is the most relentless with his fury towards her. But because it's Amos, it's just like, it's not even fury. It's just kind of nonchalant doneness. Just coined a new term. He's just done. So that was really harsh, actually.
Yeah, even more so than with Holden, because at least with Holden, you could tell that kernel of affection and the feelings he had for her were still there.
And there's like a sexual element, like that changes things. Like, you know, if you think about real life, if you're getting that good sex from someone and they betray you, sometimes there's that thing where you're like, oh, but I just want to curl up with you again. And I think Holden and Naomi have that, where they have a physical affection. But with Amos and Naomi, it's almost like a son-daughter thing. And I think it's like that thing of when, you know, when you first work out that your parents are humans and you have that awful moment of they do something and you're like disappointed and they fall from that pedestal that you had them on and you're like, oh dear, you're like human. I mean, I had that. So.
Oh, sure.
I feel like we all go through that when we flip into adulthood and we realize our parents are humans. And I think that was that for Amos and Naomi, where he's just like, your pedestal is gone. It's gone. But because they are adults, he doesn't forgive her very easily. He doesn't need to.
Yeah. Was that physical pull you mentioned between Naomi and Holden, was that something that you and Steven worked out to play? Because it did feel, even when the scenes when they were fighting and arguing, that there's almost like that, you're just waiting for them to fall into each other's arms or something. Yeah. Was that something that you guys
set out ahead of them? We just love each other. No, I think we have that, like, you know, like as friends, me and Steven are very intimate and we talk about a lot of stuff. Like, you know, it's not, nothing's restricted with us as friends. So I think we can transfer that over into something on screen that looks like a romantic relationship, because we're quite open with each other. And he did really wanted to push for Naomi and Holden's intimacy, because we don't have a lot of sex on the show. And I think that's quite an easy way to portray, you know, a romantic relationship, but we don't have a lot of that on our show. And our writers didn't want to put a lot of that in. So we were very much like, okay, we need to make sure that we're making this convincing, you know, without the obvious like sex. Like, we need to make sure that it looks like these two people are intimately involved. So me and Steven talked a lot about that, and like body language and what their conversations would look like if they were in love and having lots of sex and confined to this tin can. Like, so yeah, it was quite a challenge actually. That's probably been the biggest challenge for me on The Expanse, is like trying to show this very romantic relationship without the audience seeing much romance.
That's interesting. And especially because the thing that, you know, most of the time when a romantic relationship falls apart, it's because of some transgression or some decision on a romantic level. Sure. And this had nothing to do with that. This was purely a political thing.
Yeah. An idea. Why can't I say the word? You know what I mean? Like ideas, like morals and whose side you're on, like politically, like, which I find interesting, because what I like about The Expanse is it is always mirroring real life. But in this case, I feel like sometimes that happens in interracial relationships where, you know, if it's not planetism getting involved, it's race. And it's like, you know, I've had it myself with some white guys I've dated, and I'm mixed race, and okay, I'm half white, but like there is this fracture of understanding of privilege and maybe what it's like to be, you know, of color and be white, and what you're afforded when the police stop you when you're white, and having a white guy just not really understand it. And then that changes the relationship, because you as a person of color realize that you're not fully understood. And I think that was kind of the thing I was talking about with Steven. I was like, okay, in this case, it's me talking about being a belter, and you don't understand an earther's privilege. And you think us belters are out here just crying about our circumstance. I was like, this is like situations I've had with white guys where they don't understand, you know, my qualms as a woman of color. And it's really interesting to play that out in a situation where it's not about color and it's about injustice and it's about my people. Or in the same way, like in Britain, if I've dated a guy who's of an upper class than me, because I'm a working class girl, and them not understanding what it's like to be a person or be part of a single parent family that is on the benefit system and in social housing, and this idea that everyone's scroungers, and I'm like, you don't understand it unless you're in it, you know, like things like this, which we were basically playing, but in a kind of allegorical different version of it. So yeah, I can't remember what my point I was trying to make, because I've just gone off on
That's all really fascinating, because again, you know, I was going to ask about like drawing on, we've talked with Ty and Daniel, and Cher and I have talked a bit, you know, in this episode about how situations we've been in romantic relationships where you've been broken up with someone, but kind of forced to cohabitate together, or whatever. And to see that there was even an additional layer on that kind of fed into how you were relating to Steven in the scenes. It's really fascinating.
Right. So that's what's happened with Naomi and Holden. It's like they have a moment where they're just like, oh, I love you, but you, what do you mean you don't understand Beltus? And I, yeah, but no, this is the situation. And he's like, no, but, and then they just have that moment of, oh, you don't get me. You don't get me. And you and your Earth of Privilege walking into Belter meetings and thinking you can just speak out and have Anderson Dawes watch you and have Fred Johnson be okay with it. No, you don't get to do that. And yeah, I can compare it to a million situations that I've been in. So it's interesting, you know, like you find elements of your characters that are more like you than you realize. And for me, being a working class woman of color, with Naomi, I'm like, oh, girl.
I mean, that's ground that they actually, no matter what understanding they come to otherwise, can never make up. You know what I mean? There's no, he's never going to not be an Earther. She's never going to not be a Belter.
Exactly. And it's hard for people to understand their privilege. Even with, like I was saying, with white guys I've dated, it's not for not wanting to know. It's not because of not wanting to empathize or be there or change it. It's just, it's hard to address someone's privilege when that's what you've always known and you've worked hard, or, you know, you think you've struggled. It's hard. And I really liked that about Naomi and Holden, because for me, it was quite true to life. And I was like, he just had this privilege that he couldn't wrap his head around, of why there wasn't like equality or why everyone didn't feel the same. Because for him, it was simple. He had simple ideologies of what side you should be on. And for Naomi, it was much more complex. So that was, I love that element of their relationship. It's my favorite thing. And then to see them fracture because of that was just like, oh yes, this is what happens in real life. Fab.
But all that said, as you got more and more scripts from the season, was there a point you were just like, oh, come on, it's time? I would say, as a viewer, there were a couple moments, like in, I think it was episode five, and then the one before, where I was just like, can't they just kiss already?
Well, I think that's how you always want it to be. Like, you know, it's like, okay, we're in a TV show, but I think few episodes ago, if it was life, Naomi would have left. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, we've got to factor in the fact that, like we say, there is a tin can and she can't just leave. So you do end up going over old ground. But I think if we were humans on Earth, you know, me, Dominique, I would have just turned around and been like, this isn't going to work. And you're wonderful, but we're just not on the same page. And no matter how much I try and educate you about it, I can't. It's impossible. So, you know, like, this has been my experience. I've tried to date white Republican guys and it doesn't work. No matter how much I want it to, being a liberal woman of color, it's like going up against a brick wall, no matter how wonderful they are. So I think if we weren't in space, Naomi would have been like, dude, you're the best thing since sliced bread, but for who I am, this is not going to work. So, yeah.
So all of us who ship Naomi and Holden can be thankful that it's a space show.
Yeah.
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 So, but at the end of, so we just finished episode six, Naomi has...
No, we finished episode five, no?
No, six.
No, it's five.
No, we just, this is for episode six, which airs tomorrow. Oh. So this won't actually be on the...
Shit, I haven't watched episode six yet. Have you watched it?
I have.
Oh, so you know what happened.
I do. That's what I was going to address with you. Okay, was, go. You know, Naomi's... change of heart in this episode, or I guess the way she's kind of come to this arc of putting it to a vote as to whether to execute her plan of giving those missiles up to Fred Johnson.
Yeah, so I haven't seen episode six yet, but I'm pretty sure that is when I make a decision.
It is.
So
couple of big things coming out of that. Yes. One is, you know, her plan to give up those missiles to Fred so that he can shoot down the Martian or the hybrid pods.
Which is the right decision.
It is. But the interesting thing being she puts it to a vote. Whereas I think Naomi of a season ago might not have done that.
Well, this is Naomi, I think, with her towel between her legs a little bit. And we don't see her like that much because she's always right. And so I think this is her way of really patching it up before she makes the decision that she makes. And I think it's, you know, she's a smart woman. And in this instance, she learns from her mistakes and she doesn't repeat the same pain that she inflicted on everyone. So I think, I don't ever think she shrinks on her decisions, but I think she can see when she's done damage and she just wants to fix that with the men that she loves. Really?
Yeah, the impression I got, you know, I think she still believed in that plan as much as she believed in her decision to give the protomolecule to Fred.
Yeah.
But was willing to make them a part of the process more than she was the first time.
She doesn't want to hurt them again. And she doesn't want to leave with that bad taste in her mouth. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the other big thing is we get this moment, we get this wonderful moment of Naomi and Holden finally having, you know, reconciled physically, so to speak.
Yes.
Which was a really beautifully shot scene. And then at the end, we get she's leaving.
I know. So this is what I was talking about. I didn't realize that you'd seen episode 6, but I was like, nobody kind of guessed that she would reconcile and leave.
Yeah.
No one guessed that. Everyone was like, it's either they fix it and they stay together or they don't. And then she leaves. Nobody kind of, you know, like her world does not evolve around Holden. And so for her, she wants to fix things. She doesn't want to leave, but she needs to go find herself. And so she leaves.
Yeah. Which was just like, it was a wonderful contrast in that scene, I felt, because you're right. There was that moment of like, oh, they've reconciled and they're, you know, back in bed together. Everything's wonderful. And then, I mean, it's just, and you guys are both, you know, physically naked and I feel very emotionally vulnerable and naked in that moment as well.
And we wanted it that way. It wasn't originally wrote like that.
Oh, really?
And I was like, I think we need to be naked, guys. And everyone was actually a bit against it, but I was like, we never see them post-coital or like, we never see them in these moments. And I was just like, if this is going to be where she leaves, like, let's let them be naked. So I was like, Stephen always has his ass out. And I was just like, do you know what? I'll take one for the team. I'll get mine out on this occasion.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen it yet, but it felt on the day a beautiful moment, and I think it was earned for them.
Very much. It's a very beautiful scene, just in terms of the way it's shot. And, and again, like you get the emotional vulnerability along with the physical vulnerability. That's very cool.
That's what I wanted. That's what Stephen wanted. So I hope that translates and it also informs later moments between them. So that scene is really important.
Cool. Was it hard to do the emotional beats of that scene being distracted by Stephen Howe, like his abs?
Do you know what? Honestly, just before we laid down in the bed to do the scene, like I'm like naked with nipple pasties on and like, this is going to sound gross, but it was just like a band-aid over my vagina. And he's there with a sock on. And I was just like, I can never unsee this. Like, why are we standing here? Like, as if this is our job. And we were actually giggling with each other about it. It's so funny because sex scenes are so unsexy. Like, you would never believe it. And so, you know, you really have to trust the person that you're doing them with. And it's not, it's not necessarily about the sex. It's just the fact that you're in this ridiculous situation with someone. And I'm just glad that Stephen is the kind of man he is. He's so respectful and makes me feel so comfortable. And I hope I do the same for him. But we did have a little giggle before we lied down. And then, you know, we're invested in the story. So we've been working together for so long now that his abs don't distract me as much as they did when I first saw them.
It's a desensitization process.
Yeah, I'm just numb to it. But he's very beautiful. But we... yeah, we really wanted to make sure this moment was rewarding for these two people. So that was our focus, and our team are awesome, like our camera guys and our director. So everyone fully supported it, and so I'm looking forward to seeing it. I hope it's as beautiful as we hoped it would be.
I think it was, but I'd be interested to hear how you feel about it when you see it. Well, is there another, so we've talked a lot about your performance on the show. Is there another performance, either this season or just in general, when you watch the show that you really admire, or somebody who you're just like, wow, I really enjoy watching that person work?
Oh my God, I have so many. Like, okay, recently, I'm a bit more of a film person. Like, I do watch TV a lot. I think in TV, Handmaid's Tale, Elizabeth Moss, Yvonne, who is actually a friend of mine, but she's fucking fantastic in it. That whole show actually just floored me. That's been a big moment for me in TV. I don't feel like I've ever seen a show like it.
Yeah.
And then film, like Call Me By Your Name just wiped me out. I was a mess. Lady Macbeth is fantastic. Florence Pugh is a genius. Moonlight was a big thing for me. A beautiful film that I just adored. What else have I seen recently that I've just been like, sure.
How about on The Expanse, though?
On The Expanse?
Yeah. Oh, these are all great. I'm glad to get
to sorry, I'm like, it's just to completely sidetrack. I love Anna, who is a new addition to the show.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Mitchell is a fantastic person, and I love what she does with that character. I love all of the regulars, but, I mean, Thomas Jane, I just think is a genius, and I love doing scenes with him. Same with Shireen Dashlu. I'm a little bit in awe of everyone. And there's David Strathairn, who is coming up.
Oh, right. I forgot he was on the show this season. Yeah, he's a great actor.
His scenes are just... He is fantastic in the show. So I'm very excited for everyone to see him because his work is phenomenal. And we see a lot more of drama. And Cara G is also phenomenal.
Is there any more Space Handball coming?
Ooh, you'll have to see.
That would be a spoiler. I know. I'm sorry.
You'll have to wait and see. but that, I mean, the show is a little bit profound for its performances. I mean, even the last episode, episode 5, the guys that came in and were like on the Martian ship and on the UN ship, like they've done work. Like, they're not even regulars, and they came in and was just like incredible. So I think we're a bit spoiled on The Expanse for performances because everyone comes in and does their best work. Oh, and Sean fucking Doyle, like, come on. He is.
You know what's funny is that every guest we've had on the podcast this season has shouted out Sean Doyle so far.
Because he's fantastic. Yeah. And actually, Nick Tarabay is also fantastic. I mean, I could actually list everyone, but I guess I'm a little bit more numb to the people that I've been with the whole time, you know, like the boys.
It's like, oh, Cassie's okay.
Oh, he's average.
No, I'm asking you. I'm not asking you to like basically pick between your collaborators.
No, it's just difficult because they also all elevate my performance, like because everyone's they're bringing their A game. So the show is just a fucking anomaly, to be honest. It's from cast to crew. Everyone is out here like. We want to win Emmys and everyone, you know, not that that's a real kind of goal, but the way that everyone does their job on our show, or did do their job on our show, was just like second to none. So it's hard to pick anyone because they're all fantastic.
Yeah, I completely understand that. And I agree. But that's pretty much all the questions I have about the show. We usually do the whole shout outs thing. You just gave a bunch. Do you have anything else in particular that you're watching or reading or enjoying right now that you want to shout out?
Oh my God, I read so much. I recently read Audre Lorde's book, Your Silence Will Not Protect You, and that changed my life. I feel like we all need to read a lot more black feminist literature.
Agreed.
So Audre Lorde is a good place to start with that. And I'm currently reading Clarice Lispector, who is a Brazilian, well, she took up residence in Brazil, but just writes the most incredible short stories and is like a hidden gem of the 19th century, I think, or 20th, might be 19th. I'm not always good with these things, but I'm reading her at the moment. So that's all fabulous. And yeah, that's kind of, I've just moved house, so I've not been watching much TV, but lots of reading.
Yeah, no, that's good. I agree. We should all be reading more of those kinds of books. Oh, so.
Audre Lorde is just profound. Yeah. So I want everyone to read her stuff.
Excellent.
And well, also,
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just like on a nutrition side of things. I think we all need to read Kelly Brogan's book, which is also profound. Your, what's it called? A Mind of Your Own, which is really interesting about the gut-brain connection.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to make the call and everything.
Of course.
We had a little technical hurdle here and there, but I really appreciate it.
Yeah.